It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps.
This is the hottest 200-meter field ever assembled at the Olympic Games.
This week, we're thinking about running and about what it takes to win the coveted title, fastest person in the world.
Second attempt now to get them away.
That's Sha'Carri Richardson, one of the top sprinters in the world. She aced the Olympic trials, but was suspended after testing positive for marijuana, a widely legal substance that, if anything, would retard performance.
I just say, don't judge me. I am human. I'm you. I just happen to run a little faster. I greatly apologize if I let you guys down, and I did.
There's no question. Marijuana is against the Olympic rules. But critics wonder, is that the only reason Richardson was banned? Or did her neon orange hair, massive tattoos, eyelash extensions, long acrylic nails, and black skin also have something to do with it? There's a long history of racial bias in sports, and the sprint, one of the marquee Olympic events, is no exception. 1936. The Berlin Games. American track and field star Jesse Owens wins 4 gold medals.
The world's most superb runner makes the others look as if they're walking.
Adolf Hitler won't meet or shake hands with him. Worse, in Owens' view, Franklin Roosevelt, his own president, doesn't send a telegram. None of the 18 African-American athletes who competed in the Berlin Olympics was invited to the White House. Only the white Olympians. 1968, Mexico City. At the awards ceremony, American sprinters John Carlos and Tommy Smith raised their fists in the air after winning their medals, maybe the most famous Black Power salute ever given.
The victory ceremony, unfortunately overshadowed by politics.
And the most controversial. Half a century later, John Carlos remembers the decision, the moment, and the fallout. He told Steve Paulson he was inspired by a meeting with Martin Luther King Jr.
I went into the room, and many of the people in the room looked familiar based on what my parents used to see on TV relative to Southern Christian leadership. But yet and still, while I'm sitting there nervously looking to see what's going to take place, I still didn't put the dots together in my mind in terms of where I was or what was about to happen to me in my life. And about 20 minutes later or so, Dr. King walked out of the room. My lip just fell all over the floor in terms of me being in a room with somebody that my mom always revered as God's first lieutenant that he sent here to earth to try and deal with the issues. And here I'm sitting in the room. I'm thinking my mom needs to be a rock in my pocket or a bug on my lapel. She needs to be here. And he noticed right away that I was a little nervous about being in the room. And what I noticed about him is that he was very perceptive and at the same time, very comedic. He was a jokester to the point where he cracked so many jokes to relax you. He relaxed me and others in there, I'm sure. Then when we went into the meeting, certain things that he said stuck out in my mind. Like, for instance, he made a statement that they sent a letter to him and told him that he had a bullet with his name on it and he wouldn't have to wait long for it. That stayed in my mind, in front of my mind. The second thing is, probably which was the most important thing relative to the meeting was the fact that he was going to come out in support of the Olympic boycott. He felt that he didn't want to be in command. He wanted Professor Edwards to be in command, but he definitely wanted to be the support factor right up under Professor Edwards.
And did you support that? Would you have supported a boycott of the Olympics, which would mean that you wouldn't be able to compete there?
That was my game plan to support, but I thought that we would have a unified effort in terms of a staging a boycott. In this meeting, things became crystal clear because Dr. King asked, was there any questions? I had 2 questions. Quite naturally, the first question would be, Dr. King, if they threaten your life, why would you go back to Memphis if they threaten your life? And I recall I used to wear shades all the time, and they didn't dilate like they do now. And I remember pulling my shades down on my nose so I could look into his eyes. I wanted to see whether this man had any fear for the fact that someone told him that he was getting ready to leave this planet. I saw no fear whatsoever. He was as solid as a rock. And then beyond that, I saw that he had love for humanity. The love that I saw in his eyes was like he said, I didn't make a partial commitment. I made a total commitment. If I have to sacrifice my life for what I believe to be right, then so be it. So I was really stuck by that. So I asked him, I said, why would you go back? And he said to me, he said, John, that's a very good question. But I have to go back and stand for those that can't stand for themselves. And John, I have to go back and stand for those that won't stand for themselves. And then in time goes by, you begin to realize those individuals that he was going back to stand up for was the sanitation workers. They wasn't all black sanitation workers. They wasn't all white sanitation workers. There was a multicultural involvement in the sanitation department at that particular time. And then it leads me farther to believe that Dr. King didn't die as a result of his civil rights activities. He died because he got involved in the economics of this country. So as the people out here at Wall Street, the people here in Wisconsin or Chicago or Boston or wherever, they're concerned about the economics of this country because it's affecting everyone, just the same as Dr. King felt it was affecting the sanitation workers at that time.
Now, of course, the boycott didn't happen, I suppose partly because Dr. King had been killed.
Well,
no one really took leadership of this boycott.
Well, that was the second question I had to Dr. King. Did you ever play any sports? You play basketball? Did you box? Did you do anything? He said he couldn't shoot pool. My question was, why would you get involved in the Olympic boycott? And he said, John, he said, that's a better question. He said, just imagine you being out in the middle of a lake and the lake is still and serene. And you reach down and you pull out a rock and you drop it in the lake. He asked me, he said, what happens? I said, it vibrates. He said, yes, it's waves. He said, the waves go out to the far ends of that lake. That Olympic boycott is that rock. He said, if you guys chose to back up, opposed to going to the Olympic Games, he said, would make a statement that would ripple throughout the world as to what would make these individuals step back and give up something that they've trained for all their lives. Something must be wrong. Let's have some sort of dialogue and try and understand it. But many individuals felt that they've worked so hard to win a gold medal or to win a medal at the Olympic Games. This is something that's embedded into young individuals, you know, the Olympics, go for the gold, you know, it's a glorifying situation. So therefore, it was very difficult for many of them to say, I'm willing to sacrifice my 15 minutes in the sun. And we felt that we didn't have the right to tell them, you must not go to the Olympic Games. But what we did feel was we had the right to sit them down and let them know both sides of the table in terms of what you're getting in your 15 minutes in the sun and what you could possibly do for humanity, for your kids and your grandkids in terms of making it a better world for all people. But the overwhelming factor is that those individuals felt compelled to go to the Olympic Games. Now, when they decided to go, the question for me was whether I was going to stay home, because I could have quite naturally stayed home. But I felt to myself after thinking about it that had I stayed home, the United States at that time was the greatest country in the world as far as track and field is concerned. Someone from the United States would go and win a medal in my place, get on the victory stand. I really don't believe that they would have gotten up there and represented John Collins the way he felt he needed to be represented at that time. So I was compelled to go to the games.
So take me to the games. You and Tommy Smith were two of the fastest 200-meter runners in the world at that time. There was a good chance you were going to win medals, get up onto the podium.
Well, you know, any great athlete, you know, when I say great, I mean super great. If you're going to have a bad day, God will let you know when you get out of bed that morning that you're going to have a bad day. We had no qualms or no hesitation about us making the team. We knew that we would make the team. And I told Tommy at the quarter semi, after the quarter semi was over, we had a discussion, and I told him I was disenchanted about the fact that the boycott was called off. I felt like I wanted to make a statement. What's your take on that? He said, I'm with you. From that point on, we started talking about what artifacts we had we could bring to the table, which was the black gloves, which was a black scarf, which I had a black shirt. I had beads. We decided we would wear black socks out there with our pants rolled up. We had no shoes out there. Each and every one of these symbols had a specific meaning, and if you bear me the time, I'll explain them to you. The black glove was based on the fact that we felt with an open fist, there's five people of color, and each one of them are very sharp, have a very strong paradigm as to how things could be better. But either one of them step out on his own to move a pebble, he couldn't move it. But then when you say, all right, next time we come together and say we have a unified vision as to how we can make things better, such as a possibly a boycott or what have you, and all these people come together in a very powerful force. Well, you couldn't move a pebble by yourself. Now, unified, you can move a mountain. That was the concept of the fist and the glove. The scarf on Tommy's neck was to show black pride. I had a black shirt over my USA jersey to indicate that there was sorrow about the fact that we had to go to this extent to get America to wake up and realize its misdeeds in society. Then we decided that the beads that I had on my neck would be for all of the lynchings that had taken place that I've read about and heard about as a young kid coming up in this great country of ours. And then we wore no shoes with long black socks to indicate those individuals that was in the South at that particular time, and I'm sure they're still there today, walking to and from 10, 20 miles to school without shoes. We wore the Puma shoe, or we put the Puma shoe out there merely because the Puma shoe was a shoe that was a concern about people of color that didn't have the means to go out and buy the proper shoes, but they was very kind-hearted to give individual shoes before they even got a reputation.
It's sort of extraordinary what you're describing. The symbolism there is overpowering. You got the bronze. Tommy got the gold. Peter Norman from Australia got the silver. All up on the podium there. And then when they started playing the Star Spangled Banner, you and Tommy raised your
fist. We walked out, I mentioned to Tommy that, hey, man, you remember when we go out there, I said, people are going to be applauding, and then there's going to be a void, and that void would be total silence because they would be in a state of shock once we started to perform our deeds. And at the same time, I told Tommy, remember, we've been threatened. Our lives have been threatened. So remember this, man.
Well, why had you been threatened?
Well, based on the fact that we was proposing an Olympic boycott. They felt it was anti-American, you know, and many of the haters out there didn't particularly like the fact that you would step back. They feel that, oh, we giving you this honor. No, you didn't give me an honor. You set a standard. I took the honor to step up and qualify to make the Olympic team. I want America to represent young individuals in regards to what their ethnic background is as much as these young individuals honor America. That's what our stand was then. That's what my stand is today. So when we went out there, I told Tommy, be careful, man. We've been trained to listen to the gun. If you hear the gun, hit the deck. We went out there. We put the shoe down on the victory stand. As they acknowledged us, Tommy, I believe, raised his glove and the shoe on his foot up to the spectators. And then when we received our medals and we turned to the right to the flag and they started to sing the national anthem, and then we come out with the gloves and raise our fist to the sky. Just like I said, this void came over to the point where it was silent for a matter of seconds. And then it went from silence to total screaming of the national anthem. It's almost like they were singing the national anthem in a sense that we're going to shove this American national anthem down your throats whether you want it or not.
And then you got booed, right?
Oh, it was a tremendous amount of boos.
What was the fallout for you personally? I mean, for starters, just as an athlete, weren't you kind of ostracized by the track and field establishment?
Well, I was ostracized to a sense, you know, but I wasn't weak enough that they could run me away. I decided that I was going to run for 2 years, and I always thought about how they tried and slam down our throats that national anthem, and I wanted to slam down their throats that I was going to be the best in the world. Anybody you bring, I was going to wear them out for you to let them know I'm here to run, and I'm here for anybody you want to bring against me. But yet and still, you know, I had aches and pains relative to the demonstration. I would say that probably the most important thing that was most hurting or disturbing to me when my first wife took her life as a result of the Olympics, the pressures that were put upon us, the lack of money into our household, the contempt that came into our household.
No, and you should elaborate on that because, I mean, reading your book, the FBI followed you.
Oh,
they would plant rumors about you. You
put rumors out. Well, it's no different than what they do today to anyone. They did the same thing to Dr. King. And then at the same time, my kids had to endure ridicule in school merely because when the teachers found out they were my kids. So I had to endure all of these things. I remember I had to get $100 here, $200 there, and get somebody to drive me to Vegas just so I could roll the dice to pay my mortgage. 29 days out of the month. If it was 30 days, I'm working 29 days to get my mortgage payment so my kids wouldn't live in the street. I remember chopping up my furniture, taking my kids and tell them, take your clothes out of the bureau drawer and put it on the floor there. And I would go take a claw hammer and chop that furniture up, go put it in the fireplace because I could not pay my electric bill. I didn't have groceries. I had some dear friends that came and said, John, I don't have much, but I see you don't have nothing in your cabinets and came and put food in my house. Many individuals walked away from me at that particular time that I thought were my friends. It took me a minute to find out that they walked away not because of disrespect or dislove. The majority of them walked away for fear of reprisal. If you was associated with John Collins, what's happening to him can come and happen to you as well.
Do you ever have any regrets for what you did back in Mexico City?
No regrets whatsoever. And if it was necessary for me to step up tomorrow, I would never hesitate to step up for what I feel is right. People say, you sound like you still running. Sound like you still got the fire. Well, the fire was with me when I came, the fire being with me when I left, until justice is brought here for all men, women, and children on this planet. Someone has to step up in order to make it better. What good is my life being here if I'm here and I got kids and grandkids coming into this world and I'm in a position where I could bring attention to something to try and make us solve this problem or make it a better situation, and now I'm getting ready to leave and I haven't done anything to try and make a better life for my kids or their kids? That's what it's about.
Thank you.
Right on.
John Carlos held his fist high after winning the bronze in the 200 meters at the Olympics in Mexico City in 1968. He talked with Steve Paulson.
I'm proud to be an American. But yet and still, even far greater than that, I'm proud to be a human being. I would be even prouder if I can be treated as such.
Coming up, what does it take to reach your own top speed? The science behind running very, very fast. Next. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. And PRX. The world's top runners today are unbelievably fast. I mean, just think about the 100-meter dash, one of the marquee Olympic events. These days, it's over almost before it begins. Usain Bolt, who holds the world record, ran it in 9.58 seconds. And on the women's side, Florence Griffith Joyner finished in 10.49 seconds. You watch these races and you think, today's athletes are just better, faster, stronger than anyone who ever came before. But then again, maybe that's not quite fair.
Jesse Owens ran on a track made of cinders. He didn't have starting blocks. They would dig holes to put their feet in at the start. It's not hard to imagine that Jesse Owens would have run much faster than he did in 1936 today, that maybe he would have been as fast as Usain Bolt is today if he'd had the advantages that Bolt had, where billions of people around the world will see him run live in real time on a track surface engineered for speed, using cleats that have been designed for his unique biomechanics as he runs, with a training regimen that's been planned down to the day on how to get the absolute peak performance in that one moment.
This is Wired Magazine's Mark McCleskey. He's the author of Faster, Higher, Stronger, The New Science of Creating Super Athletes. And he argues that the kind of peak performances we see today are not necessarily because athletes are better, but because science and technology are.
I'm saying that, yeah, I'm saying that a huge factor in how athletes are able to perform at these different levels is through science and technology. Things like interval training, which is a concept that even most recreational athletes are familiar with, right? That instead of you just go out and sort of do a run or a bike ride, how about you go out and go slowly and then have like really hard efforts from time to time. Mm-hmm. That you overload those physiological systems and they sort of adapt to that workload and become stronger. That was a concept that had barely been explored in the 1930s. It really originated in Finland, and that's how sort of Finnish runners in the 20s and 30s into the 40s were world-dominant middle-distance runners. They were the only people training this way, which turns out to be an incredibly effective way to train. But that was unknown. That was a new concept in the world.
What goes into achieving world-class performance today, if you look at the Olympic sprinters and runners that we'll be watching next week?
It's an unbelievable sort of support system and structure of exercise physiologists and biomechanists and nutritionists and sports psychologists and, you know, people to manage sponsorships and the financial support to do it. We have this romantic notion of sort of like an athlete and a coach go and isolate themselves and are able to reach the pinnacle. And while it's still possible, it's really unlikely that the sort of structure that you need to bring all of these specialties to bear onto an athlete's performance is pretty vast. It's a lot. And when you're dealing with a performance environment where the difference between winning an Olympic gold medal and being one of the most famous people on the planet and finishing fourth and nobody ever hears of you again is measured in hundredths of a second, sometimes thousandths of a second in some event. And so those little tiny gains, that's sort of what every athlete is looking for, and they're looking for it through any vector that they can possibly find.
Mm. The thing I never understand that always puzzles me is there was a long period of time when people wondered if it was even possible for a human being to run a 4-minute mile. And then Roger Bannister did. And then after that, now high school athletes do it. So performance has to be more than just better tracks, better running shoes, great science. There's something else.
Oh, the mind is, that's the frontier here, is really understanding what happens in the mind. I mean, you talk about Roger Bannister, you know, he was not the only person trying to break the 4-minute mile. And people came close and started to talk about a barrier, right? And then he does it and suddenly 3 people do it in the next 6 months.
So do you think that'll happen with the 2-hour marathon?
Perhaps. I think the 2-hour marathon is right at the very outer limits of our understanding of human physiology today.
So there are limits. There are limits to human physiology.
So I did phrase that carefully. It's right at the boundaries of our understanding of human physiology today. So the things I want to point there are our understanding and today. Mm. So when we talk about the mind, there's a lot of really interesting research about what is fatigue? Is fatigue a physical thing that happens in our muscles? That's been the sort of dominant understanding of fatigue for most of the history of exercise physiology. But, you know, this idea like I'm lifting a weight, I'm doing curls, and then my muscle just says, nope, no more. Like the muscle is out of something or has some sort of waste product in it or has been limited at the muscular level mm-hmm. from doing any more work. When you start to look at that person in a lab, you find out that at that moment of I cannot budge this weight, only 40% of the fibers in that muscle are contracting.
Wow.
So why is that? Yeah. Why are we only using 40% of that muscle? What's controlling that?
And what would give you access to the other 60%?
Exactly. So broadly, the theory has come to be known as the central governor theory, and it's this idea that fatigue is an emotion. Does not exist at the muscular level, but exists at the central level, at the sort of, let's call it the mind, but it could be more complicated than that. You know, the argument for the main central governor theory is that our mind is constantly calculating how much further we have to go, how much effort it's going to take to get there, how we're feeling, the feedback the body is giving the brain, and it's constantly balancing all of this.
The other thing that I took away from your book is the idea of approaching your own performance, whether it's in sports or life, I guess, as an experiment.
I'm glad you took that away. That's sort of my other thing is record data, even if it's like, did I wake up happy today? Right? If you start to know things that feed into your happiness, you can start to affect it. If you start to see, oh, I'm running a little bit faster when I do this, then you can double down on it. But if you aren't capturing that information, you're just sort of groping for things without being able to measure any effects. Like Peter Drucker has the famous sort of business line, what gets measured gets managed. And that's true. So whatever it is you're trying to do, change is hard. Like improvement is hard. Changing things in our life is difficult. But if you aren't keeping track of it, if you aren't viewing it as an experiment, it's very difficult to know where you've started from and where you've gotten to.
Become a scientist of your own life.
Yes.
Thanks so much, Marco. It was fun talking.
Thank you.
Mark McCluskey is the author of Faster, Higher, Stronger, The New Science of Creating Super Athletes, and How You Can Train Like Them. So science and technology are improving athletic performance by leaps and bounds. But what about for those of us who just want to stay fit? Well, for us, thankfully, there's Gretchen Reynolds, the New York Times columnist and author of The First 20 Minutes. Written nearly a decade ago, it's still one of the most widely read science-based guides to training. Well, Gretchen, there's been a lot of attention paid lately to humans as a running animal. Some people even say we were born to run, designed to run. Do you think that's true?
The science actually doesn't really support that idea that we're born to run. It appears both from the fossil record and from sort of anecdotal evidence that we actually are born to walk. We're much more efficient. The human structure, the skeleton, is much more efficient at walking than at running. When they bring people and other animals into the lab and put all of us, the people and the other mammals, on treadmills and test how well we move, humans are exceptionally good at walking. We are better than almost any other mammal in terms of how well we use energy. And we're really poor in terms of running. We're not nearly as fast or as efficient or as speedy as most other mammals. We just like doing it.
And at the same time, I think of running as just walking but speeded up.
Well, yes and no. It actually is a different stride. When you walk, one of your feet is always on the ground. And when you run, there is a period when you're not. And for whatever reason, we are actually not as efficient as four-legged mammals at running. We can outwalk them by a long ways.
It seems to me that in some ways, there has never been a better time to run. Practically every week, there's a new study or some new research out that sheds new light on the physiology or the biochemistry of running. And for exactly the same reason, there's never been a worse time to run, because we are just presented with a barrage of new information all the time. Is there a consensus emerging about best practices?
I will say what seems to be emerging is what common sense would probably have told us, which is the human body definitely needs to be moving, and running is a really good way in a concentrated period of time to move. But the best science suggests that moderation, unsurprisingly, is the ideal approach to running. There was a really interesting study that was presented at the meeting of the American College of Sports Medicine that looked at how much running is best for your lifespan, meaning what amount of running will give you potentially the longest lifespan. And it wasn't a lot of running. It was running about 3 miles, 4, maybe 5 times a week at a pretty slow or at least moderate pace of about 10 to 11 miles per hour, which is, for a really serious runner, would be considered slow. For me, it's now rather fast. But that's a really manageable amount of running. There's some evidence that doing a lot more running may not necessarily be healthy, and doing a whole lot less you won't get quite as many health and fitness benefits. But that moderate amount of running appears to be the absolute sweet spot. Mm.
You titled your book, The First 20 Minutes, sort of suggesting for those of us like me who have to force ourselves to exercise that perhaps 20 minutes would be enough. Is that true?
Yes, although it depends on what your goal is for exercise. And that's a really important message, that if your goal is to be healthy, to have less risk of heart disease, diabetes, dementia, obesity, if that is your goal, then it appears that the first 20 minutes of moving will provide most of those health benefits. And that's any type of moving. It doesn't have to be running. Walking, cycling, going upstairs, gardening, any type of human movement is really important for health. And most of the benefits of exercise or activity in general are gathered in the first 20 minutes compared to sitting on the couch.
And do those 20 minutes have to be consecutive? What about the suggestion that it's okay to break it up and do it in 10-minute chunks?
Yes, there's some very good science suggesting that what scientists call fractionalized bouts of exercise, which means 10 minutes at a time, even 5 minutes, if that's all you can manage. If you get, say, 3 10-minute bouts, 2 10-minute bouts during a day, you will get most of the health benefits, probably all of the health benefits of 20 or 30 minutes consecutively.
And then for those of us who would like to get really efficient about exercising, there's this high-intensity interval training that turns out to be really effective. But the bad news part is that it's really got to hurt. Can you tell me about this?
High-intensity interval training is great for both health and fitness. What it means is essentially you do short bouts of hard work, meaning you run or cycle or swim hard for 1 minute, then go easy for 1 minute, go hard for 1 minute, easy for 1 minute. If you can do that 10 times, which would be 20 minutes, with a short, say, 5 minute warm up, 5 minute cool down, then in 30 minutes, you can get both the health and the fitness benefits. Scientific studies have shown of about 90 minutes of much slower endurance exercise.
As we move ever further down the path of creating a culture that is almost entirely sedentary, in the sense that, you know, most of our jobs increasingly don't necessitate movement. Most of them involve sitting in front of a computer screen. So is there a kind of basic bottom line, like what do you need to do to keep all of those physical systems and mental systems in good shape?
That's actually a really interesting question, because there is a difference between exercise and just being in motion. That's one of the things I found most interesting in the reporting that I've done, is there's a whole new understanding that sitting a lot, even if you regularly exercise, is very unhealthy. There's a modern phenomenon that's called the active couch potato. And that is many of us, actually, including me. And that's people who may exercise at lunchtime and then sit the entire rest of the day. That's really unhealthy. The exercise will not completely undo the health problems of sitting for 8-10 hours a day, which is average for Americans.
Gretchen, I'm paid to sit for 8 hours a day. What are we supposed to do?
Well, and I'm paid to sit and write about exercise. What happens when you sit for really extended periods of time is a number of systems start malfunctioning in your body. You start producing less of an enzyme that breaks up fat in your bloodstream. That fat then goes to your muscles, your heart, your liver. The big muscles in your body are not contracting, so you're not pulling as much blood sugar out of your blood. So you start having too much insulin. That's the beginning of type 2 diabetes, insulin resistance.
Hence the rise in diabetes in the U.S.
Yes, including among people who exercise. The answer is actually surprisingly simple. Stand up. There's very good and growing evidence that standing up about every 20 minutes is really important for good health. And it doesn't mean that you have to do anything while you're standing up. You don't have to jog in place. You don't have to run. You don't have to do jumping jacks. You can if you choose to and if your coworkers will put up with it. But there have been a number of studies that have found that if you stand up about every 20 minutes for, say, 2 minutes, the big muscles in your legs and your back will contract. That increases the amount of enzymes that break up fat. It means you're pulling more blood sugar. They have found that just standing up more often reduces heart disease risk and diabetes risk. It also has been found to help with weight control. If you sit unendingly for hours, for 6-7 hours, there are implications for weight gain. So stand up. It's so easy.
Gretchen Reynolds talking about her 2012 book, The First 20 Minutes. Her phys ed column is among the most widely read and shared in the New York Times. We're talking about the science and art of running in this hour. And there's a style of basketball that places a premium on the full court sprint. It's res ball on Native American reservations. There's something else a little different about it. Extra magic. Unusual defense.
This is our second game of this week.
You tell us one story of when this Navajo team played the neighboring Apache team.
Red Cloud comes in 15-1. They're ranked number 5 in the state.
It's comical.
Should be a great matchup tonight.
The medicine men from both groups are trying to cast spells on the other team.
Oh, yeah. No, it was, they came out before the game, and normally, of course, everybody would shake hands. If you carry a bad spell, traditionally for both Navajo and Apache, you would carry it in the palm of your hand. So none of them will shake hands with each other. They're literally like touching their elbows or their forearms to each other. I talked with Raul Mendoza, the coach that I was with, but also with the Apache coach afterwards. They said, yeah, they're both convinced the other team has, like, the serious mojo.
The tip will come down to Jayshon Morissette, and over to Bo Donovan. Red Cloud has the ball.
You will see medicine men standing up in the top of the bleachers, and they're kind of just talking to themselves, and what they're doing is they're saying prayers or whatever they're saying.
Inside the world of res ball, next. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX.
Thank you.
Sports can be so many things. Competition, athletic prowess, exercise, and also cultural identity. New York Times reporter Michael Powell saw that firsthand when he spent a season covering high school basketball at Chinle High School in the Navajo Nation in Arizona. The story he tells in his book Canyon Dreams is about basketball and a whole lot more, as Steve Paulson discovered.
So res basketball, basketball in the reservation, is a really big deal, right?
It's a really big deal. As one of the coaches said, he said the five biggest sports on the reservation are basketball, 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 rodeo, or the reverse.
So this is a particular style of ball?
Yes, it's res ball, which is this incredibly fast-paced, run, 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 pass, 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 cut, cut, cut. Played well, it's beautiful.
Where does that style come from?
Yeah, it really comes out of, I think, their history and their culture. The Bureau of Indian Affairs for generations used to come and force families to give up their kids that would go to faraway boarding schools where the idea, as they said, was to, you know, basically burn the Indian out of them. And they would wash out their mouths if they spoke Navajo and all this kind of thing. They started playing basketball at these places. And what is sort of wonderful is that they made it their own. And how so? Number one, running, distance running, goes deep into the all the tribes of the Southwest, the Hopis, the Pueblo tribes, the Apache, and the Navajo. And the other is they have a very communal culture. So basketball, this kind of the idea of 5 or 10 kids melding together, very much kind of fits in with their culture. It's interesting when they really get going, they'll often bring in players in groups. It's almost like hockey. Whole separate slot of guys.
So you have
in.
Like 5 guys subbing out and then 5
yes,
new guys, and they just run at full speed.
Yes, yes. Run, run, run. Now, played badly, it can be chaotic. Like all sports, done well, it's a thing of beauty, and done not so well, it's not so much a thing of beauty.
Well, and I would think especially if they're playing teams off the res, the white kids who are sometimes quite big, maybe they can run circles around them.
That's a great point, because it's very interesting to watch them play teams off the res, particularly Anglo teams, white teams. Almost invariably, in fact, I think with this team, they played their best games against those sort of teams because there was a sort of a concentration, frankly, a matter of pride. So these big teams would come in very often, front lines 6'6", 6'7". I mean, the tallest kid on the Navajo team was 6'3". After that, there was one kid who was 6 foot. Everybody else was under 6 foot.
So why is basketball such a big deal on the reservation?
Well, at this point, it's generational. Families will come in, great-grandparents, grandparents, parents, cousins, aunties and uncles. It's not unusual to see from any one of the players' families, 15, 18 people come to a game. They'll sit there through the ninth grade games, ninth grade girls and boys, JV boys and girls, varsity boys and girls. So they'll be there for 6 hours, a lot of these families.
So this is the big social event.
This is the event. And they'll have 5,000 people. I mean, Chinle is a town of 3,500. They'll have 5,000 at big games.
So they come in from the...
all over the place. Wow. Guys will hitchhike in from the outback. All of those generations have played hoop. And to dominate at the high school level is like the Everest for Navajo because, particularly with the boys, they don't go on. They're not big enough to play big D1 schools. I mean, they just can't do that. So that most of them, this is it. A few will play community college ball.
You got to know the coach of this team, this 70-year-old guy who had spent decades coaching, not so much at this school, but all kinds of different schools, mostly on different parts of various reservations. Tell me about him.
Yeah, Raul Mendoza was a terrific character and kind of my, in a sense, my guide, because he was a Tono Odom Indian. I may have butchered the pronunciation, but it's a tribe, quite poor tribe, that spans the border, Mexico and Arizona, and came north, taught himself English, got an education. He's coached essentially on the Navajo or the Apache, and the Apache are sort of their genetic cousins, the same Athabascan people. And he's coached on those reservations his entire life. He's married to a Navajo, but he's never of Navajo, and people know that. At the same time, he is a Native American, and he understands, you know, all of their cultural yearnings, the fears. Do you leave the reservation? If you leave, can you ever come back? Can you make your way in the Anglo world if you want to get an education? So he spends a lot of time on headwork, essentially, with these teenage boys.
So I'm assuming this is a lot more than just plotting out the X's and O's of basketball games. I mean, this is, I mean, he's a counselor. He's guiding these young men into figuring out what to do with their lives.
That is precisely how he conceives of his thing. As he says, you know, he's about turning around in 20 years and hopefully seeing most of these boys living productive, healthy lives. And that's not such an easy thing if you're coming from the reservation in northern Arizona.
Life is hard there for most of these kids, right?
Yes, it's very hard. It's an enormous place. It's the size of West Virginia. There's not much there. I mean, if you're, let's assume that you're one of those kids 5 years later and you've gotten yourself a college education, you come back, you could work as a school teacher. There's jobs at the hospital. And then there's a few other jobs. That's it. I mean, the unemployment runs 40% approximately. They deal with all the problems that confront not just Native Americans. I mean, certainly we're hearing a lot about rural America, right, and the terrible problems confronting whites in rural America. But I mean, they confront those same problems. But alcohol is their great carnivore, their great pursuer, and that's a big problem. And so, you know, if a kid comes back, let's say he's got a degree, and he comes back, and at first you're welcomed by all your hundreds of relatives, and everybody's really happy to see you, and then you look up a couple of months later, and it's like, well, now what do I do?
Yeah. I would think for you, as this Anglo reporter coming into the Navajo Nation, writing the story, it must have been hard. Was there any part of the story that was especially hard for you to understand? I don't know, maybe traditional Navajo beliefs?
Yes. I mean, certainly the traditional Navajo beliefs fascinated me, and it's a completely different cosmology.
You tell these stories that are just remarkable. I mean, stories of apparitions and shape-shifting and animals turning into people, and these weren't just once-in-a-lifetime kind of stories. I mean, it sounds like this stuff happened fairly often.
Oh, no, there is a profound belief in the immaterial there. I heard it from virtually everyone there. I first started to notice it when, before games, big games, the boys would all like roll up, you know, either bee pollen or different herbs into their socks. Every family would do a protection way prayer, usually before the season. Sometimes there would be prayers before big games. Now, you could say, well, you know, okay, in the NBA, you see guys pointing to the heavens or crossing themselves. This is different. This is a real sense that tonight there could be medicine men in the stands putting a hex on me, like doing things that are going to make it difficult for me to play well.
And does any of this seem to work?
They're convinced it does. There was one incident in particular. This was not while I was there. It was a couple years earlier. They had played, I think it was on Hopi. And all of them, including the coach, Raul Mendoza, said that they felt like they were playing underwater the whole game. Everything was moving in slow motion. This was a very big game, like in a haze. All described the same thing. The next day, somebody that he knew, that Raul Mendoza knew, said, well, yeah, you've got to realize that the medicine men for the Hopi had put kachinas, their magical dolls, at all four corners of the arena and had done ceremonies before that were designed to leave you befogged. You know, who am I to say? I mean, you start to hear these stories. I mean, Mendoza, who, interestingly enough, was a Assemblies of God evangelical. He is a serious Christian. But, you know, he had a tale coming back. It was when he was coaching on Apache, and some of the families were angry that their kids weren't playing. And one of the families that was angry, the mother was a very powerful witch. He had been warned that she was going to put spells on him. And one night, he's driving back through the White Mountains to his home, and his daughter is following behind in a car. He's in his pickup truck, and an enormous alabaster white owl, just enormous, dives right at his window in his telling. He kind of flinches, and at the last second, it zooms up into the air, doesn't hit the window, goes up over his car. Now the daughter picks up the story. She's about 100 yards behind him. It's middle of winter. There's snow on the ground. It comes down, lands on the asphalt right behind his truck, and turns into a white alabaster person and runs off into the woods. Raul and his daughter, they don't drink a lick. They are not, tellers of tall tales. They said this happened. Just it flat out happened.
So what do you do with those stories? You were in this culture for months, living there, listening to all of this. How do you process that?
I think there's, to the extent that I can figure these things out, I do believe that there is a notion of a collective unconscious. I heard too many of these stories from people in a matter-of-fact way. It wasn't like to make you scared. It's just like, this is life. So I guess I take them seriously. That's a different thing than saying I know what to make of them, because I don't. But I think the immaterial, the membrane between the material and the immaterial is so thin as at times almost not to exist. And who's to say that they aren't open for that reason to things that, lie in our dim past of our peoples?
Yeah. It's a great story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Michael Powell is a New York Times reporter and the author of Canyon Dreams. He talked with Steve Paulson. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced in Madison, Wisconsin by Shannon Henry Kleiber, Angelo Bautista, Charles Monroe Kane, and Mark Rickers. Our technical director is Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. And hey, are you a TT Books super fan? We sure hope so. If you want to hear more from us, make sure to subscribe to our weekly free newsletter at ttbook.org/newsletter.